speech delivered on October 24, 2021, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic and foreign participants in the 35th International Islamic Unity Conference.
Regarding the issue of acting in accordance with the all-inclusiveness of Islam, there has been an insistent effort, mainly on the part of political and materialistic powers, to reduce Islam to matters related to the individual and belief only. They desire that this inwardly political and ostensibly intellectual tendency, important areas of life and social relations, to be liberated from Islamic interference. In managing society and building civilization, they say Islam has no role in building human civilization. It has no duty and there is no place for it. Islam has no role in the management of society. It has no role in the distribution of power and wealth in society. The society's economy and various other social issues have nothing to do with Islam. This is what they say.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The same is true of war and peace, domestic and foreign policy, and international issues. They sometimes say, do not turn diplomacy into ideology. Do not connect it to ideology. They mean that Islam should not comment on foreign policy and international issues. In matters of spreading goodness, establishing justice, confronting evil and oppression, and combating villainous forces of the world, Islam isn't effective. This is what they say. In these important areas of life, Islam is neither an intellectual reference point nor a practical guide. This is precisely what they insist on. Now, the reason for this insistence and its starting point are issues that are not related to my speech today. What I want to say is that, first of all, this truly anti-Islamic movement is mainly launched by the great political powers of the world. They are the ones who are active and working in this field, and they try to promote this using their intellectuals.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
the limelight.
Christian Drosten, a leading virologist and coronavirus expert, has repeatedly warned in recent weeks that the vaccine and booster jabs alone will not be enough to control the spread of the coronavirus in Germany, and that physical distancing rules will have to be reintroduced. We now present you an article written by Kate Connolly. The piece is titled "Germany Set to Tighten Rules for Unvaccinated as COVID Cases Rise." Germany is paving the way for introduction of tighter restrictions on people who have so far chosen not to be vaccinated against COVID-19, in an effort to control its highest infection levels since the pandemic began. On Tuesday, 16th of November, the country's disease control agency, the Robert Koch Institute, recorded a seven-day incidence rate of 312 cases per 100,000 people, with several areas at more than 1,000. A year ago, before the vaccine was introduced, the rate stood at 139. There were 265 deaths reported on Tuesday in Germany, much fewer than the pre-vaccine peak. With the country in political limbo, the old government of Angela Merkel operating in a caretaker capacity until a new three-way coalition takes the reins of power next month, management of the pandemic appears to have lost direction. Less than 70% of the population in Germany is fully vaccinated, leaving Germany considerably behind other European countries, such as Italy, Spain, and Portugal. The spread of the more infectious Delta variant of the coronavirus, an increase in communal activity, a return to the workplace and a sluggish rollout of booster vaccines, which are recommended 6 months after the second jab, have been blamed for the increase in infections. A rise in health conditions usually related to the colder months has contributed to some hospitals being on the verge of being overwhelmed. Some hospitals in Germany have stopped all but essential surgery to cope with the increase in patients. The state of Saxony, where 85% of intensive care unit beds are occupied by COVID-19 patients, became the latest to introduce so-called 2G rules in all non-essential shops and facilities, meaning only people who can prove they have been vaccinated or have recovered from COVID will be allowed entry. Saxony's social minister, Petra Köpping, said that in addition, tests would be required if the incidence continued to rise to the extent that hospitals were unable to cope. 2G is a reference to the German words for vaccinated and recovered, geimpft und genesen. North Rhine-Westphalia is due to follow suit, with unvaccinated people to be excluded from entry to all non-essential facilities and events, including football matches and Christmas markets. People wanting to attend carnival events as the season kicks off will be required to take a test in addition to being vaccinated or having recovered. The mayor of Berlin, Michael Müller, said on Tuesday, 16th of November, the city is also on track to introduce similar 2G plus rules. The city of Berlin hopes to reopen vaccine centers which were closed across the country at the end of the summer when they were deemed no longer necessary. But authorities have said this would happen in January or February at the earliest. The 2G regulations are similar to, though not as stringent as, rules introduced in Austria on Monday, 15th of November. on the rich unvaccinated people above the age of 12 in the states of Upper Austria and Salzburg have been confined to their homes for 10 days, except for necessary tasks such as going to school or going to work, to the doctor, or shop for food or for exercise. Police are carrying out random spot checks on individuals and have the power to issue 400 euro fines. Austria has an incidence rate of about 850 cases per 100,000 of the population. As the Social Democrats, the Greens and the pro-business FDP entered what they said were the final rounds of negotiations in Berlin about forming a coalition government next month, they announced they had agreed on new, tougher coronavirus measures to be applied across Germany. These include only allowing people onto buses and trains if they have been vaccinated, have recovered, or have tested negative for the coronavirus. It was unclear on Tuesday, 16th of November, how this would be implemented. Another measure being pushed by the Greens in particular is a vaccine mandate for people in certain fields of work, such as care homes or hospitals. The FDP has called for a vaccine mandate in the armed forces. The Social Democrats' Olaf Scholz, the likely future Chancellor of Germany, said he was in favour of a vaccine mandate if there was widespread consensus for it. An opinion poll on Tuesday by the pollster Forza showed that 53% of the German public were in favour of the idea. The three parties have said they will resist a blanket lockdown and instead are in favour of legislation to allow each of the 16 states in Germany to impose their own restrictions. Measures introduced as emergency legislation in the Bundestag that gave the federal government the power to introduce disease control restrictions are due to expire on 25th of November. There has been criticism of the new German government that by allowing nothing comparable to take its place, a signal is potentially being sent out that the measures are no longer needed as the pandemic is under control, which is clearly not the case. The Forza opinion poll showed that 60% of the German public are against dropping the measures. Christian Drosten, a leading virologist and coronavirus expert, has repeatedly warned in recent weeks that the vaccine and booster jabs alone will not be enough to control the spread of the coronavirus, and that physical distancing rules will have to be reintroduced. Angela Merkel and Olaf Scholz are due to hold a video conference session with state leaders in coming days to discuss the next measures. The Chancellor of Austria, Alexander Schallenberg, said the lockdown of the unvaccinated there had already started to have an effect, with more than 500,000 people in Austria opting to get a vaccination in the days before the lockdown, and vaccine centres reporting a heavy stream of people seeking a jab since Monday, 15th of November. The Chancellor of Austria, Alexander Schallenberg, said that is exactly what we wanted to achieve. His aim was to persuade the unvaccinated to vaccinate and not to lock up the vaccinated. About 65% of Austria's population are vaccinated. In Upper Austria, one of the main hotspots, clinics reported 59 deaths in 4 days. A record number, and there were 93 COVID patients in intensive care beds, 80 of whom were unvaccinated. Under normal wards, 3 out of 4 of the 513 people being treated for coronavirus were unvaccinated. hospitals in Salzburg said they had been overwhelmed with patients and had introduced a triage system to decide which patients should get an intensive care bed.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Kavitat Lee. The use of sanctions as blind instruments to pressure nations. That is one accusation that has been leveled against the UN, an international body that was created to resolve world crises, not to be a tool by mostly Western veto-wielding members to be used against other nations. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will examine the shortfalls of the UN Security Council, the reforms that many are asking for the Council to go through, particularly why it has been used as a tool for political gains.
The Security Council is one of the six primary organs of the United Nations, created after the Second World War. The Council has wide-ranging powers, including the approval of changes to UN charters, enacting international sanctions, and even authorizing military action. The UNSC is arguably the most powerful UN organ because it is the only one with the ability to pass binding resolutions. Hence, it would not be an exaggeration to say its decisions could have global impact. However, despite its immense importance, the Council is anything but inclusive. Although the UN General Assembly has more than 190 members, only 15 are in the Security Council. Of those, 10 gain their seats on a rotating basis, while only 5 countries, namely the United States, the United Kingdom, France, Russia, and China, are permanent members with veto powers. This puts enormous power in the hands of only a few governments, which have time and again shown they are not afraid of using it. In the past, the Council has imposed sanctions on countries like Libya, North Korea, and Yemen. Iran, also a victim of UNSC sanctions, has censured the Council's use of such restrictions under unsubstantiated pretexts. Tehran's UN ambassador on Tuesday described sanctions as blunt and blind instruments that raise fundamental ethical questions. He said the sanctions should be reserved as a last resort, but right now they are being used as a tool of collective punishment.
In the past, certain Security Council sanctions have served only to collectively punish an entire nation, without any actual positive impact on the maintenance of international peace and security.
Furthermore, the Iranian ambassador criticized the UNSC's makeup. He declared that the Council must be reformed to ensure equitable rather than geographical representation. He also slammed the disproportionate presence and power of Western nations in the influential organ.
Currently, the West has a strong presence and influence in the Council. Three of its members have veto power, while the main regions are fully represented in terms of both the number as well as privileges, including veto power. This means inequality among the regions.
The stated goal of the Security Council is to maintain international peace and security, but on numerous occasions, it has in fact acted as an obstacle in the way of justice. For instance, the veto-wielding United States has blocked the passage of over 50 resolutions critical of Israel's policies since 1972. And U.S.-backed Israel, too, has defied dozens of resolutions on its crimes against Palestinians with impunity. The Security Council's far-reaching jurisdiction makes its importance hard to overstate. That significance is perhaps exactly what makes the Council's overhaul more needed in the current circumstances.
Our guest joining us for this edition of the Spotlight, we have Alfred Desaias, who's a former UN Special Rapporteur on the promotion of a democratic and equitable international order. Also joining us is Macharia Munin, a UN expert on decolonization, who joins us on the phone from Nairobi.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, let me first start with you, Alfred Desaias, if I may. And I would like to ask whether you agree with this stance on the UN, that it is a truly representative, effective, transparent, accountable, and above all, rules-based body.
I could, huh? In my 14 reports to the Human Rights Council and the General Assembly, I frequently identified the obstacles exactly to being such an effective rules-based organization. My former boss, Secretary General Kofi Annan, was one of the first to recognize the problems and to propose very concrete reforms to the United Nations in general and in particular to the Security Council. In my 2013 report to the General Assembly, I also laid out a plan of action how to reform the system, how to reform the Security Council. And I reflect that, by the way, in my new publication, Building a Just World Order, which also includes 25 principles of international order. Of course, we can and must reform the United Nations. But obviously, those five powers that possess not only permanent membership but also the veto power are not likely to give up their privileges that easy. Article 108 of the UN Charter allows for amending the Charter. It has been used before. The size of the council, for instance, has been increased. Kofi Annan proposed that it be increased from 15 to 25, and obviously that means that major countries like India and Brazil and Japan also have a claim to membership in the Security Council. Whether they would ever get the veto power is something else. Initially, I used to be very critical of the veto power. On the other hand, I remember a debate I had in the General Assembly, and the Russian ambassador at the time took me to task because I said, look, if we didn't have the veto power, NATO countries would go ahead and bombard the rest of the world and call it legal because it would be approved by the Security Council. And then he said, look, we made a mistake back in 2011 when supposedly humanitarian assistance was going to be given to Libya. And instead of humanitarian assistance, what NATO did was to bomb the hell out of it. That was Resolution 1973, which went through not with the approval of Russia and China, but with their abstention. Uh-huh. So in the future, clearly, the Soviet Union, or rather Russia, and China have blocked supposedly humanitarian intervention resolutions tabled, for instance, against Syria. And that is
right.
Understandable. So if you're going to do away with the veto power, make sure that that doesn't open the floodgates for indiscriminate attacks
sure.
under Chapter 7. It is Chapter 6 of the UN Charter that should be used, which is the Charter on Pacific Settlement
okay.
of Disputes.
All right, let's bring in Macharia Munin into this. Macharia Munin, our guest there talked about one example, and that was the Libya case, and also he talked about the veto power. In your assessments or in your recollection, what perhaps has led to calls for reforms for the UN? What examples can you give us or reasons that you think the UN needs to be reformed? And where did it go wrong that this call was made? Because it's been in the works for quite some time, the calls for reform for the UNSC.
That's different. When the UN Security Council was formed back in 1945, the logic of it was that the Security Council was there to protect the interests of the then big powers. That's why they gave themselves veto, that they were the one to determine what is safe for the world, and in case any of their interests were to be infringed by global democracy, then they gave themselves the power to reject global democracy. So the environment of the 1945 after World War II is now very different. We have more countries, we have more assertive interests coming into field, and we have seen over time that the big powers of the day at that time, which appeared to be in agreement, are no longer working together. They do not look after the interest of the world. Instead, they look after their perceived interest. And sometimes they make decisions that would otherwise not be acceptable just because they are big. The example given about the invasion of Libya through the UN Security Council's supposed resolution is an example of that. Of course, there have been issues of vetoes when it comes to what Israel does or does not do. And in the days of the Cold War, there appeared to have been competitions between the United States and the Soviet Union as to who can veto more than the other the UN resolutions. So now, with the increasing talk of global democracy, and it is an increasing talk of global democracy, then the idea that one country can veto the world interest becomes obnoxious. We also have a few more countries that feel that they are strong enough to be in the big boys club. So you have Brazil, you have India, you have Japan, you have Germany, which are big economic powers, but they are not acceptable because they were supposedly not there in 1945, or they were on the wrong side of the big powers of the day. Today, some of them are seen to be good countries, mm-hmm. yet they are not acceptable into the Security Council as permanent members. The
okay.
challenge that comes is convincing the five permanent members that they should expand their numbers and dilute their own power is a very challenging thing.
Sure. Well, that's one of the things that Alfred Desaias, I'm curious as to how it can be solved in terms of the fair distribution of a say for countries that do not have representation, in a matter of speaking, or even continents. I mean, you're looking at the five countries that have the veto power. Is this the major, you think, problem that the UN has? Because when you have the Middle East, or we call West Asia, or Africa not having that representation, then what can be done? Adding countries to the list, is that a solution? This is for Alpha Desires.
No.
You get the Alpha Desires, this question is for you. Go ahead.
Well, I fully agree with what my colleague, Professor Macharia Munene, just said. Beyond that, obviously, just a numerical increase of the Security Council will make it somewhat more equitable, somewhat more representative of the world. But what you want also is what Ambassador Majid Tanta Ramanchi said, to address the ethical issues that are involved. There, about a third of the population of the world is suffering under illegal unilateral coercive measures, which have been condemned by the General Assembly and have been condemned by the Human Rights Council repeatedly. What the international community has to do, and that is the responsibility of the General Assembly, is to elevate the issue to the highest judicial instance of the United Nations, being the International Court of Justice. And it is quite clear to me that sanctions kill. Not only do sanctions kill, but they kill hundreds of thousands of people. Because that is that, it should be declared not only illegal, because it is, of course, illegal, but a crime against humanity. And then that should be referred on to the International Criminal Court to prosecute those countries that have imposed sanctions on other countries which suffer, they're crippled, for instance, in the battle against COVID-19, and their economies are asphyxiated. So that has to be addressed, and these are ethical issues. These are issues of human rights, of the right to life, of the right to food, of the right to water, etc. So back to the reform proposals, yes, let's increase the membership from 15 to 25, but there are many other mechanisms that must be put in place.
Uh-huh.
There is, by the way, a working group of the General Assembly that is looking and has been looking for the last 15 years, looking at reform. But of course, that gets systematically blocked by those who are not interested in reform.
Sure.
But the possibility is there, Article 108 of the UN Charter, which provides for amendment.
Macharia Munene, let's look at a case in point here when it comes to sanctions. And that would be no better place to start with than the Islamic Republic of Iran. When you take a look at what has been leveled against Iran in terms of sanctions, the story obviously is very long. But my question to you is, do you think that using Iran as an example, that you have three of the five countries that have the veto power to have leveled sanctions against Iran for their own political gains? That is one of the critiques that has been leveled against the UN when it comes to Iran, specifically those three countries, in order to achieve whatever objectives they have by their use of sanctions, which Iran deems illegal.
The sanctions, in many instances, are placed on technicalities, many of them illegal. We do have, I think, in the case of Iran at present, there are some that were largely imposed by the last administration, the U.S. administration, which negated its own treaty on what had been agreed. And the interesting thing is that the new administration, U.S. administration, continues to stick to those sanctions and not very willing to review the whole thing. But sanctions are politically driven moves by powerful countries that use the United Nations as an instrument of their own foreign policy. So in this case, the three powers with the veto capacity are the United Nations, who are also negotiating involved in the Iran Treaty on Nuclear Activities. It is a political tool, and this should be understood that way. As to whether or not there can be reforms, we can demand reforms. In fact, it is an attitude thing, and it is for the General Assembly collectively to come together and shame the ones who are standing on the way of reform, and to point out that the sanctions which are targeted for the wrong reasons are actually tantamount to criminality in the global thinking. But that mind frame of the big powers, that they have to protect themselves irrespective of what, is what needs to be, it's unethical, but it's a moral issue, and they need to be ashamed in order to see sense that they should accommodate other people.
Okay, Alfred Isaias, I'm going to ask you whether you can guess what entity we're talking about here. And this question that I have for you is that since the inception of the council, this would be the UN HRC, okay? Since its inception in the year 2006, it has issued 142 condemnations against UN member states. Out of the 142, 95 was leveled against, and I'm wondering if you know who that would be.
Well, the United Nations Human Rights Council does have a focus on Israel, and it does have a permanent item on its agenda on Israel. So it's no surprise that there are so many resolutions adopted against Israel. On the other hand, you have to consider that since 1967, there is a Security Council resolution 242 that condemned the occupation of Palestine territories by Israel, and that in 2004 the International Court of Justice issued a very clear, long advisory opinion on the illegality of Israeli actions in Palestine territories, in particular the building of the wall, and that Israel has flouted countless resolutions of the General Assembly and of the Human Rights Council. So, hello. I mean, you cannot be part of the international community and continue flouting the violations, or rather the resolutions that have been adopted, telling you to correct the situation. That's why the General Assembly, surely the Security Council will not adopt resolutions against Israel, because they will be vetoed either by the United States, the United Kingdom, or France. On the other hand, the General Assembly can here take the lead and in particular elevate a number of legal issues under Article 96 of the UN Charter. The General Assembly can ask the International Court of Justice to rule on some of these issues. And I'm saying not only Israel, also on the issue of collective punishment.
Sure. But my point here was, when you have the incident that happened at the end of October, and let me make sure that I get this right, where you have the, at the UNGA, you have the Israeli ambassador to the UN, Gilad Erdan, at the podium there, tear up that report. It just shows that Israel doesn't want to follow international laws, which it keeps breaking, and resolutions are leveled against it. That was the point that I was trying to get at. Unfortunately, we just are fresh out of time. I do have to end this spotlight, but thank you, Alfred Isaias, former UN Special Rapporteur on the promotion of a democratic and equitable international order. And the name of your book is A Just World Order, which is the book by Desaias. Also, Macharia Munen, thank you, UN expert on decolonization from Nairobi. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Ikovit Tafwe, it's goodbye until next time.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
U.S. President Joe Biden's reputation for foreign policy competence was shattered by the Afghan withdrawal debacle and the loss of American and Afghan lives. Normally, loyal foreign allies complain noisily about chaotic mismanagement, and voters listened. The row with France over a U.S.-UK.-Australia defense pact known as AUKUS, has deepened disillusion over his commitment to multilateralism. We're prepared for an article written by Simon Tisdall. The piece is titled, Old Man in a Hurry, Biden Must Act Quickly to Save His Presidency. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Is U.S. President Joe Biden failing? Less than 9 months into his presidency, rising numbers of Americans and not a few foreign allies appear to think so. Recent opinion polls by Gallup and Rasmussen put his national approval rating at minus 10 points. His overall poll average is minus 4. That compares with a positive approval rating of 19 points in January when he took office. These figures suggest one of the steepest ever early falls in presidential popularity is underway. Jolting, too, is a new Harvard-Harris survey giving Donald Trump a 48% favorability rating to Biden's 46%. Among independent voters and in battleground states, the outlook for Democrats appears grim. In Iowa, 62% disapprove of Joe Biden's performance, while 70% say the country is on the wrong track. Michigan and Virginia tell similar stories.
numerous factors are contributing to what is starting to look like a presidential meltdown. At home, Joe Biden's handling of the pandemic attracted growing criticism during a summer COVID surge. Continuing mistreatment of migrants on the Mexican border, which he promised to end, is a lose-lose issue for him. A Biden-backed police reform bill, prompted by the death of George Floyd, was killed off in Congress recently. Abroad, Joe Biden's reputation for foreign policy competence was shattered by the Afghan withdrawal debacle and the loss of American and Afghan lives. Normally, loyal foreign allies complained noisily about chaotic mismanagement, and voters listened. The row with France over a US-UK-Australia defense pact known as AUKUS has deepened disillusion over its commitment to multilateralism. Joe Biden practiced use of long-standing connections, personal acquaintance, and avuncular charm to get his way brings diminishing returns. Chinese President Xi Jinping reportedly refused a summit meeting. Russia's leader Vladimir Putin met him in Geneva, banked the kudos, then carried on regardless. Biden waited days for a phone call last week with France's President Emmanuel Macron. Biden's recent speech to the United Nations helped explain the feeling of disappointment and disconcerted surprise that has developed around the world. His delivery sounded tired and uninspired. It reinforced the Sleepy Joe caricature that recently saw Benjamin Netanyahu claim that Biden dozed off during talks with Naftali Bennett, his successor as Zionist regime prime minister. The speech's substance was revealing too. Joe Biden's boast that the United States post-Afghanistan was no longer at war is demonstrably untrue. Think of Syria and Iraq, think Somalia, think other counterinsurgencies where troops are deployed. His claim to be waging a new war of relentless diplomacy brought scowls from diplomatically snubbed France and others in Brussels and Beijing. Joe Biden claimed he does not want to fight China. He said, "We'll stand up for our allies and friends and oppose attempts by stronger countries to dominate weaker ones. But we're not seeking a new Cold War or a world divided into rigid blocks." That claim sits oddly with the AUKUS Pact, the refurbished Quad Alliance with Japan, India and Australia, and his call to arms in the Indo-Pacific. When Joe Biden says America is back, some who initially welcomed it, such as Germany's exporters, now tend to duck or run for cover. While international perceptions matter, it is Americans who will make or break this presidency in the next 12 months. That's all the time Biden has left before next year's midterm elections to enact an extraordinarily ambitious legislative agenda, including a $3.5 trillion social spending plan and a $1.1 trillion infrastructure package. Obstacles include a recalcitrant Republican Party egged on by Donald Trump, wafer-thin or non-existent majorities in the House and Senate, and, in another unwelcome surprise, vocal internal opposition from progressive Democrats. By linking the two measures through last-minute brinkmanship, hubris and haggling, hard-line liberals risk wrecking both. Joe Biden badly needs a big legislative win to halt the slide in his ratings and show skeptics that he can deliver. He also needs Congress to prevent a government shutdown in the coming days and a possible U.S. debt default next month by agreeing to roll over funding and increase the statutory cap on federal borrowing. given Republican enmity, it will go down to the wire. A fierce partisan fight continues over immigration reform. Joe Biden and his underperforming Vice President Kamala Harris, maliciously nicknamed the Border Tsar by critics, were lambasted recently by their own envoy, who resigned over abuses of Haitian migrants. Joe Biden's continued use of Trump's punitive deterrent measures dismays supporters. Right-wingers say he's too soft. Is Biden trying to do too much, too quickly? Probably. There have been purported successes. The vaccine rollout, the $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill, the return of the Paris Climate Accord. In terms of forcing social change, he seems to want to make up for what his cautious former boss, Barack Obama, failed to do all at once. If Joe Biden, 79 in November, is an old man in a hurry, it's because he lacks time as well as votes. The Afghan imbroglio and the AUKUS row betrayed a tin ear. Joe Biden believes in alliances, but when the chips are down, like his predecessors, he acts in America's self-interest, deaf to the consequences of others. Likewise at home, he believes in reform, but try as he will, he cannot drown out the reality of a divided nation or the pernicious, still potent legacy of Donald Trump, who daily plots his downfall from the extra-large seat of his Florida Gulf buggy. Latest opinion poll trends and the political dynamic in Washington point to a Republican takeover of Congress next year, the thwarting of much of Joe Biden's agenda, and a failing one-term presidency. This gloomy scenario may change. Hopefully it will. But the Democratic world can only watch America's unfolding Lear-like drama, and fearing a recurring nightmare in 2024, mutter all a tremble, "Please, not Trump again."